interactive dance stage, live art installations, hands-on workshops, and health and wellness pavilion. July 26th on the National Mall. Full details at wblinc.org/DMVMade. See you there. Brought to you by Words, Beats, and Life with support from WPFW.
I'm Muiza Muntali, host of Africa Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
All right. Good Wednesday morning to you as we kick off another edition of What's at Stake. Thankful to Verna Avery Brown for getting this thing started in the very beginning. And now several people share this Wednesday time slot, one of whom is we. So I am now, just for this week, on and maybe some other months as they come, because I'm gonna help out What's at Stake. Now that I have moved to Mondays at 11 on WPFW. Oh, I didn't introduce myself. Reverend Mark Thompson here. Matsumela Mapfumo, native Washingtonian, glad to be back here with you. And those of you who've been listening for the past few months have heard me. But now my regular show, Make It Plain, is now on WPFW every Monday at 11 a.m. Be sure to check it out. We had a great discussion this past Monday about the Commanders Stadium. And so that was a good conversation to have. Today, we're also, I think, going to have a great conversation. And that conversation will be about reparations. An issue that we can't talk too much about. Reparations is that issue. We can't talk enough about reparations. We had a big reparations assembly a couple of months ago. In Washington, D.C., with just about every reparations organization that you can think of, but excluding some, and we may have to talk about that. If we had to talk about it, we got to talk about it. Because reparations has become a very popular issue. My involvement in the reparations movement goes back to the 90s when John Conyers was still alive. And the only legislation on the table was H.R. 40. Now we have local legislation everywhere. And that's a good thing. So we are going to have that conversation today with our guest, Ray Winbush. He'll be joining us momentarily. And we look forward to speaking with him. But just to get things going, what's your take on reparations? What's your take on reparations? How do you feel about reparations? Do you support reparations? Do you think reparations is something real that will happen in our lifetime? What do you think? Is that something that you think we can actually realize in our lifetime? 5880-893-202, 5880-893. Give us a call. It's something that we ought to have. It's something that we fight, ought to fight for. Like I said, I go back to the 90s in the struggle. And it was sort of a fringe issue for a long time. It wasn't a fringe issue. It was considered fringe. We were called fringe folk. We were called a far left, radical, revolutionary fringe movement. All right. That's how people saw it. And there were a handful of us. And everybody thought that that wasn't going to happen. But we have stayed true to that. What are your thoughts about reparations as we await our guests? Caller number one, go right ahead. Caller, what's your name?
Good morning, Reverend Mantimiola. This is Michelle. I'm calling from D.C. How are you?
Mm-hmm. Fine, how are you?
I'm pretty good, thanks. Interesting question. And I know but what I discovered recently is that the first, one of the first formal efforts at reparations came about with the National Organization of Poor People back in the, at the end of the 1800s. It was called the National Bounty Pensions and Reparations Movement. And it was organized to secure reparations for older ex-slaves.
People, the National Ex-Slave Mutual Relief Bounty and Pension Association, founded by none other than Callie House.
That's right. Okay, so you know your history. Well, anyway, I just learned it recently. I've been sharing it with my colleagues in the National Union of National Welfare Rights Union organization. But anyway, but the whole point is that what I learned from studying that is that we will have reparations when we successfully fought back the racists who are in control of this country, because it was an organized cabal that they moved against the sister, Callie, and they eventually were able to put her in jail. But she just kept believing that, like many of us have, unfortunately, kept believing that the principles that put out for this country actually applied to everybody, meaning that they applied to us. And so, as usual, we were just trying to get what was promised to us, you know, that check that keeps coming back, insufficient funds, and this was another time. But they
you know what you just did right there, right?
What did I just do?
When you said insufficient funds, funds, you're quoting whom?
Martin Luther King,
now,
Jr.
Many people don't put Dr. King with reparations, but that's exactly, he didn't use the word, but that's exactly what he was saying. So you gave a little scripture right there. That's what you did. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's all right. I appreciate it. But no, uh-huh. I mean, so... The reality is that it is insufficient funds. We have never been paid for our labor. And it's one of the reasons why this country became one of the wealthiest countries in the world. But it also became one of the wealthiest countries because using all of the lessons and the manipulations that it was perfecting during the periods of enslavement, they continued to disable us and the rest of the members of our class, the working class. I mean, we just heard about what happened in Philadelphia, and I'm old enough to remember the New York City garbage worker strike. And I even remember going out and looking at that as a possible profession, because I remember getting all of the details on what you had to do to pass that test. So the truth is that this country has only been a democracy for the rich since its inception. But they have really pretty words that they put out there from talking about taking over other people's stuff, that what they learned from the Native Americans after they went to visit the collaboration of the five tribes, the Iroquois, the five nations of the Longhouse. And so they were invited up there, Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, I believe, was one of the others who was invited up there. But they were invited up there to learn about the Indian system of democracy. And they adopted a bunch of the language, but the one thing that they left out is that all legislation and all policies had to go through a group of women, and they had the final determination. But, you know, because this country, bringing it over from Europe, was so fully invested in sexism, one of the oldest forms of discrimination, there was no way they were going to do that because, you know, at that time, women were still property. Which I have to keep mentioning some of these things because I keep finding that there's a lot of folks who really don't know a lot of this stuff that we keep assuming that other people know. So we can't just assume that just because we know it, that other people know it too. So we have to keep sharing this information. So I appreciate you bringing these things back because everything old is new again because we have not yet won that battle, but that doesn't mean that we're going to let it go.
All right. Thank you, Michelle. Take care. Caller, what's your name?
Hello?
Caller, go ahead. Yes, hello. What's your name, caller?
Yeah, I'm Donnell.
Hey, Donnell, what it is?
All right, so I had a couple of points on this that I wanted to make. You know, I find it real interesting, okay, that we were able to talk about reparations during this time, right? And you know, within the last administration, you know, we was shushed on this whole conversation. So I really think I'm scared that we're being played again on the whole reparations thing. So when you ask, are we, you know, would we see this checking out lifetime? Man, that's kind of a slim thing to say. And I also want to draw a little point out there to you know, what Governor Westmore got going on out in Maryland in regards to reparations, how he just voted down or whatever he did to our cause, he didn't really support it moving forward. So I think we in our own way as far as reparations. We stand in our own way. Another thing, one more point, and I'll get out your way, is the question is going to have to be asked, are we really ready for reparations? Are our minds, are we prepared, are we educated enough to get the money and be able to build our community up to where we need it? And we want, you know, we can gain wealth from that because, you know, it's nothing but an investment. You get what I'm saying? And if we don't have the education or the proper tools and resources to do what we need, we'll be right back in the same place, which is the poorhouse.
So, my brother, that's very astute of you to say. Let me respond to you a couple of ways. One, you're right. Westmore kind of, you know, well, not kind of. He vetoed the reparations legislation in Maryland. That's a fact. And a lot of people have issues with that. One. Two, what you said was very astute in the sense that, you know, there's some people, y'all hear people who will say that reparations is about individual checks. And Donnell, you're right. What H.R. 40 said, what we've always said in the movement, yeah, you can have individual checks, but you also need long-term investment for our community. Because if you give everybody, let's say you give everybody a check today for $5,000 or $10,000, whatever it is, that ain't nothing no more. $10,000 ain't what $10,000 was 10 years ago. People got bills to pay. We dealing with COVID, coming out of COVID, catching up on bills. So that's one. Two, and there must be investment in our institutions. There has to be land involved, all of that. So you're absolutely right, my brother. You can't just buy everybody off with the checks. I'm gonna tell y'all right now, I'm not one of these proponents of folk check. You hear people do that all the time. Write the check, cash the check. That's not these individual checks are not enough. Long-term investment. But thank you for your call, Donnell, okay? Appreciate you. Caller, you're there. You're on next. Caller, what's your name?
Yes, reparations.
What's your name, caller?
Ross.
Hey, Ross, what it is?
Can you hear? Reparations, to me, it's a no-brainer. You're either pro-reparations or pro-slavery. Mm. Now, implementing it, that's another story. And I've noticed that we had a lot of so-called black political leaders in the past who were against reparations. Barack Obama didn't support reparations. Kamala Harris didn't support reparations.
That's not true. Reparations? Kamala Harris in the Senate.
I have statements on that, brother.
No. Kamala Harris was a co-sponsor of the companion Senate bills to H.R. 40.
Okay. But
she was a co-sponsor of S-40. There's H.R. 40 and S-40 in the Senate, and all the time she was in the Senate, she was a co-sponsor.
Okay, but I also heard a statement from her saying that she wasn't in favor of anything that just benefited black people alone.
Yeah, I've never heard that statement.
But moving along, it's do you take a stand on slavery or reparations? There's no middle road here. Now, the implementation of it, that's another story. But you have to be pro-reparations or you're pro-slavery.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's my take on reparations. It's kind of cut and dry.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right.
So,
right.
That's my take on it. And you have to have a consensus among black people for reparations, or you're endorsing slavery.
Yep.
It's
you're
like
right.
You go to work and don't get paid. You're okay with that?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's my take. You guys, thanks for your time. Have a great day.
Thank you, man. You too. Okay. So our callers y'all on this. For real. Y'all on this. Thank you. Y'all know about reparations. That's good. And that's a good conversation. Our first caller mentioned Callie House, and we're not done. We'll take more of your calls. 202-588-0893. What we've got is Callie House, who was there in the early days. Right after the Civil War. But you also had a special field order 15, which came right at the end of the Civil War, and it promised that we would get 40 acres and a mule. This happened in Savannah. I was in Savannah just the other week. January 16th, 1865. And that was before, I'm pretty sure, before Callie House. That was before Callie House. That was before her. And what happened was after the removal of federal troops from the South, you had everything rolled back from what we were to have gained prior to, well, what we would have gained after the Civil War. And it was only fair. We built that land. We established that land. So why wouldn't we reap some of the benefits of it and get some of that land? See, and that wasn't no check. That was land. Huh? There's a difference between just giving somebody a check with no land. You got land. That'll produce a check for you forever. That was what Special Field Order 15 was. William T. Sherman. Allot land to some freed families in plots of land no larger than 40 acres. What the Union had done was confiscate 400,000 acres of land along the Atlantic coast of South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida. That was to go to us. There were going to be approximately 18,000 formerly enslaved families that would have gotten that land. That was what would have happened. That was the plan. That was the plan. We're going to get Ray Winbush on the radio with us momentarily. And we're gonna get him. Ray, they're calling you on your cell phone, man. So listen out. So Ray's on. I got him. So call him now. I don't know what's going on, but it's about time, right? Okay, we'll do that. Let's take a quick break. Let's get Ray Winbush on the line, folks. We'll be right back. What's at stake? I'm Matsumela Mapfumo, Reverend Mark Thompson.
Peace. This is your social justice calendar for the week of July 7th, 2025. Wednesday, July 9th is Pan-African Community Action's next Asada Shakur study group session. The criminalization of Black youth in D.C., 7 to 9 p.m. at the Black Workers and Wellness Center on 2500 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, Southeast D.C. More info and the request to register is on criminalizingblackdcyouth.eventbrite.com. On Thursday, July 10th, from 6:30 to 10:30 p.m., Sankofa Video Books and Cafe presents Togetherness, poetry reading and discussion with poet Savannah Sweetwater Morgan, located at 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. To RSVP, go to Sankofa.com. Friday, July 11th, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., Sankofa Video and Books presents Lakita Wilson, Pretty Girl County, book event located at 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info and to RSVP, go to Sankofa.com. Finally, Sunday, July 13th, starting at 7 p.m., join Haile Garima and Sankofa Video and Books at Congo on Our Mind, featuring Ayana Gregory. All DMV artists are welcome and encouraged to participate. All proceeds will aid in supporting this station, WPFW 89.3, and 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. is the address. For more info and to RSVP, visit www.sankofa.com. WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
All right, folks. We have our guest now. He is the director of the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University. He received his undergraduate degree in psychology from Oakwood College in Alabama and received a fellowship to attend the University of Chicago, where he earned both his master's and his PhD in psychology. He has taught at Oakwood College, Alabama A&M, Vanderbilt University, and Fisk University, where he actually worked with my mom when she was at Fisk University. He is the author of The Warrior Method, Belinda's Petition, and Should America Pay? Slavery and the Raging Debate on Reparations. Our dear friend and brother joins us now, Dr. Ray Winbush. Hey, Doc, how you feel, man?
Hey, man, I'm doing fine, man. On my way to Johnny Hopkins for an appointment.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, I hope everything goes well for you. Ray, when we opened the show this morning, I took three calls. And you know what? I think you would be as encouraged as I was to hear these callers. And the issues they raised. The first caller, Michelle, said that she's just learning about reparations, and the first person she's learned about is Callie House. And I was like, wow, okay, you got that on your own, all right?
That's right, that's right.
And then she said, while she was talking, she said, we got to keep fighting for reparations to get the insufficient funds. I said, wait a minute, what you know about that, right? I said, I know who you know who you're quoting, right? She said, yeah, Dr. King. And, you know, a lot of people don't give Dr. King credit for that statement. Dr. King, he did not use the word reparations, but he was making a reparations argument, all right? Absolutely. Then we had a Donnell call. He said something very astute. A lot of astute callers in this audience. He said that we just don't need cash. We need investments. Astute. Right. And then Ross rounded things out saying that if you're not for reparations, you must be for slavery. There is no other way. There is no compromise. Ray, you've been involved in this movement longer than me. I'm not that far behind you. But if we say 30, 40 years, I think H.R. 40 was in 89. So we're, you know, about 40 years getting coming up on it.
Right.
How has the movement, do you think, grown or matured? Because I was saying to the audience, I remember back in those days, reparations was still sort of a fringe issue. You know, it was just kind of out there. That ain't gonna happen. Y'all just doing that. It was like and largely an intellectual debate. But now it's a full-fledged movement. How do you feel about how the movement has evolved?
Well, you know, it's a long story. Like you said, it was considered a fringe movement. And also a fringe movement, even among some black nationalists, where it has its origins. And so a lot of people said, well, you know, they're not going to give us reparations and so forth and so on. You know, I think when James Forman went into Riverside Chapel in 69 and interrupted the 11 o'clock service in New York City in one of the most, you know, so-called liberal churches in the nation, that people started to say, okay, we need to really look at this. Now, before that, as you just pointed out, you had three, and I'm, you know, revising my book, Belinda's Petition. Now, you really got four women who were very important. Elizabeth Mum Bett in the early 17th century, 18th century, I should say, Belinda Sutton, in the latter part of the 18th century. And then you got Callie House, who you mentioned, and then Queen Mother Moore. Those four women, you can't write a history about the reparations struggle without it. Its evolution right now is that while it remained a fringe issue, nobody paid any attention to it. Then people started paying attention to it. In COBRA, the National Council, National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America, when it organized in the late 80s, all of that, you know, still its primary mission even then was about education, because a lot of people didn't know. That will always remain its position. In 2016, the movement took, coincidentally with the rise of Trumpism, took a movement that you started seeing these other fringe groups criticizing the work that had been done by House and others, James Forman, Queen Mother Moore. And those groups have become like annoyances right now in the movement itself. They have talked about issues of, you know, we've had time to talk about it. The whole issue, only people that deserve, you know, reparation, you know, can trace their lineage back to enslavement. So we got to produce paperwork. You know, when white people came to West Africa to kidnap most of us, in fact, nearly all of us, they didn't ask for papers. You know, they just said, they're black, let's get them on board the ships. So it's a lot of things that have happened in the movement, and I always recommend people reading the history of the reparations movement through books like Mary Frances Berry's biography of Callie House.
Yes, yes, yes. 202-588-0893, your questions for Ray Winbush as we talk about this issue for reparations. And we've also seen in recent years, at one time we had one piece of federal legislation. Now, Ray, we have local legislation everywhere.
Exactly. And see, you know, Montemayor, I always felt that, and why, don't get me wrong, H.R. 40 was very important legislation by the late John Conyers, Congressman Conyers of Detroit. But I always felt that the local movements were going to lead the way. I mean, if you look at our history as a people, civil rights legislation at the federal level came last after movements occurred in places like Birmingham, Montgomery, Albany, Georgia, and so forth. And I always felt the same thing was going to happen with the reparations struggle. So now you see state commissions in places like New York, California, local initiatives like in Baltimore, where I live, all over, you know, Evanston, Illinois. So the bubble-up effect rather than the top-down effect is really gaining more momentum, actually, than some of the federal legislation.
Yeah, yeah, and that's very, very important. You're about to issue a new edition of Belinda's petition?
Yeah, I'm working on it right now. One thing that we found out about Belinda, you know, when she filed her petition in 1781, she was in her 60s at that time. And we have found out that she was married, her last name at that time, because she was enslaved by Isaac Royal, the primary funder and first funder of what is now called the Harvard Law School. She changed her name because she got married to Belinda Sutton. And we're looking at, I'm right now going back and forth to Boston trying to find out where she was buried. I think that she deserves a monument to wherever she was last interred. And doing the work similar to what Alice Walker did with Zora Neale Hurston when she searched for her grave.
She, in the petition, folks, she wrote about her abduction from a village near the Volta River in West Africa, in Ghana, and what is in Ghana, at 12 years old.
That's right.
And her enslavement now, y'all. See, we always talk about the South. She was enslaved, right, Ray, in Massachusetts.
Medford, Massachusetts, right on the campus, which is now Tufts University.
Yeah, so I'm going to tell y'all something. Somebody captured at 12. And then 1783, how old was she when she wrote the petition?
Okay, if she was 12 in 17, well, she said she was 12 in 1715, and you do the math. I'm driving, so I don't know what the math is. But she was in her late 60s, early 70s when she filed her petition. And she actually won the case. And for the first year, you know, they paid her a wage and you know, paid her reparations. And these reparations, you know, unfortunately, the state of Massachusetts, every year she had to beg for her reparations. And she filed something like three or four petitions because they wouldn't pay her. And in one of the petitions that occurred after the initial one in 1781, which was written, by the way, because Belinda was illiterate. It was written by Primus Hall, and she only lived a few miles from Phyllis Wheatley, so she may have had a hand in it. But she had to keep, you know, arguing that I deserve this because my so-called master, Isaac Royale, you know, who she most likely had a child by, Primus Sutton. You know, it's a tangled history, but it boils down to that she was liberated after that because Isaac Royale, as you know, fled to Canada because he was supporting the British during the, you know, American Revolutionary War.
Hmm. Yeah. Wow. So, folks, we're talking about, we got a couple of calls. Let's get some, we want to definitely hear from some of you on reparations. Caller number one, what's your name?
This is Rick calling you long distance from Germany, Mark.
Hey, brother, what's happening? You're on with Ray Wimbush.
I just want to ask, what is the work of the Congressional Black Caucus on the issue of reparations, and are they doing the work?
Ray, you want to take that?
Sheila Jackson Lee, the late Sheila Jackson Lee, was pioneering that work. As you know, she made her transition.
Go ahead.
Right. Who was elected from St. Louis, she took up the work, but she was not elected. So at the congressional level, it is still being the CBC level, I should say. They are still having leadership issues about who is going to lead the charge on it. H.R. 40 is still very much alive. It finally got out of committee after being in committee, you know, since 1989, only a couple of years ago. And we've got to see and continue to push for it. It's obviously more difficult to work with this idiot in the White House right now on the issues of reparation at the federal level, but not at the state and local level.
So Ayanna Pressley is now the primary sponsor of H.R. 40, inheriting it from Sheila Jackson Lee. The Black Caucus has always supported y'all.
Yeah.
So the Black Caucus is doing all it can, you know, it's everything. And there were two pieces of Kanye's legislation that were historic. Martin Luther King bill then holiday bill, national holiday for Martin Dr. King.
That's right.
And then H.R. 40 for reparations. Now, watch this. Stevie Wonder and I are the only two people on earth that have this one thing in common. We both wrote songs about and in support of John Conyers' legislation. He wrote Happy Birthday for the Martin Luther King holiday bill. And I wrote H.R. 40 Reparations Now, downloadable on all music platforms, H.R. 40 Reparations Now, co-wrote it with Common Hymnal for H.R. 40. Guess why the song is named H.R. 40. So that puts me on par on the same level as Stevie Wonder. I just want everybody to know that, okay? You got that, Ray? So
I got that, Mark.
I'm right there with Stevie. So when you got to now start saying Stevie Wonder and Mazzamella in the same sentence. Caller number two, you there? What's your name, caller? Caller, you still with us? We might have lost him. Okay. I think we...
Hello, can you hear me?
I can hear you now, yes. What's your name, caller?
My name is Diane. I'm from Kensington.
Yes, Kensington, Maryland.
Yes, and in addition to the great national work that you are involved in for reparations, I wanted to highlight an example of local work that a little bit of groundwork has already been laid in Greenbelt, Maryland. where I used to live in cooperative housing there. And the mayor of Greenbelt, I don't recall his name, but the mayor of Greenbelt about 5 years ago initiated an effort to have a study of reparations for his city. And they initiated a study, but a few years later, I looked it up and I couldn't find very much it, you know, in the public record. It seemed like maybe it, you know, they did a little bit of work and then for whatever reason it stopped. And I want to encourage them to continue. And here's why, because you spoke earlier about land reparations. And of course, one of the most important functions of land reparations would be to provide adequate housing for all people, and particularly for Black Americans. And I lived in Greenbelt for 5 years in their cooperative housing, where the cooperative organization owns the land underneath the houses, and these were townhouses. And then the owner, you buy in and you own equity in the building, but not the land. And what that means is when you get ready to move somewhere else, you can sell and realize that equity, but the underlying land remains owned by the cooperative, so it can never be, you know, corporatized or taken away or destroyed. And I think it's an idea that it's more than an idea. It is a proven model for non-capitalist housing. And what if there were a series of, what if we did that in every community, every state in the nation, and we could utilize Greenbelt as an example, where Black people, I believe, were the major construction workers in the 1930s who constructed Greenbelt for the Roosevelt administration, but for several decades, they weren't allowed to live there because of racism, which, you know, is disgusting. And land reparations specific to cooperative housing is one way that we can redress that sin.
Well,
wait, you're asking, please.
Yeah, let me give a little update on that. The reparations struggle in Greenbelt is very much alive now. I spoke there to a huge group of people back in the fall, I believe it was, and they're carrying on the work. It may have been a lull in it, but it is very much alive now. In fact, a former Black Panther, and I cannot think of his name now, but he is involved with that work in Greenbelt. So if you contact I believe there's a Greenbelt Reparations Commission or something like that. They'll tell you and talk about the work they're doing as well as how you can get involved.
Carla, are you still there?
Yes, still here. Thank you very much. I will follow up with that.
You still live in Maryland, right?
Yes, I still live. I live in Montgomery County now, and but I'm keenly interested in how Greenbelt can do this and can be a model.
So now, let me ask you, since you live in Maryland, what are your thoughts about Governor Wes Moore's veto of the state bill?
I was appalled. I don't understand why he vetoed it, and I think that he was like throwing the movement, the reparations movement in Maryland, into reverse at the very time that we need to move forward.
Yeah. Carla, thank you for your call, okay? Appreciate
you. Thank
you
very much.
Ray, what are your thoughts about that veto? And by the way, Ray, we failed to mention, you're on the Baltimore Reparations Commission?
Yes, Community Reinvestment and Reparations Commission. Baltimore is, you know, leading, one of the few cities that actually has money that we will be distributing to the Black community. What I think about Governor Moore, I think that you always have to look at politics and how people, regardless of, you know, racial delineations, you know, how people move. You know, the late Francis Cress Welsing said something to me once. We were at Fisk University, and she said, we need to have a national council, a national convention on black fear, that only black folk would be involved, no media. And we need to tell everybody, you know, among ourselves, what we're afraid of. And sometimes rather than saying, I don't like that person, or, you know, I'm running for president in 2028 and I'm fearful of losing the white vote, we should just tell people, you know, what we're afraid of, rather than being critical of commissions and the black community in general. So I think that, you know, the governor, I think, is, you know, has political ambitions. And I think this idea of losing the white vote is very much on his mind right now. You know, I don't want to be a psychologist for him, but I think that's very much, that was very much and is very much involved in the decision that he made.
So I've been told, Ray, since the last time you and I spoke about it, that it's not just the presidency, but that if the governor would have signed that bill, he would have been in trouble next year during his Maryland gubernatorial reelection.
Exactly.
The problem I have with that is, you know, I'm not trying to bring down the brother. You know, I support the brother. We all do. He's a good brother.
Yeah.
But on this issue, he got some bad advice. So the problem with that, with the him feeling threatened or fear, to use Dr. Welsing's word, the problem with there being some fear, it doesn't look like anybody's going to run against him anyway, of significance.
Right.
So you ain't got to worry about that. One. Two, that piece of legislation, if it had been left alone, once it was passed, if he had not touched it, if he had not signed it, it would have gone into effect anyway. He didn't have to do anything.
Right.
He could have just, you know, ignored it.
Yeah.
And I don't, you right there in Maryland, I don't remember seeing any movement or any media, even any movement or groundswell of discussion saying, Governor, you better not sign that bill. I think, you know, it would have just happened. So, you know, people do interesting things. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. If there's no fight, just let it go.
Exactly. Well, like I said, you know, the one thing that you look at white politicians like Trump, for example, is that he doesn't consider how black people will feel about something. You know, Toni Morrison, our great author and ancestor, said that many of us are under the white gaze, that we're always thinking and considering what white people will think about what they want or feel about us, and we shouldn't feel that way. But it's hard to get out from under the white gaze sometimes.
Yeah. You're right about that.
I've had lunch with black folk in a black restaurant, and when they say the word white people, they whisper. That's being under the white gaze. We think about them too much sometimes.
Yeah. So, Ray, are you at liberty? I don't mean to put you on the spot because we live on there. If you can't talk about it, that's fine. But you were with a group of people recently, an unusual group of people who showed some interest in reparations. Are you at liberty to talk about that?
Yeah. You talking about Chautauqua?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was invited. There's this group that has been meeting since the late 1800s up in New York called Chautauqua. A lot of black folk, you know, go up there. It's kind of like the black bourgeoisie. I was invited to give a series of lectures there. Met this guy, James Carville, that helped get Clinton elected back in the 90s and stuff. And, you know, there were a huge group of people interested, white people interested in reparations. This one guy from Rochester, New York, said they have a white organization dealing with reparations. And if you look at the polls, Mark, over time, you know, white feelings about reparations have shifted. Black folk have always stayed the same. Overwhelmingly, white people are against reparations, but that has changed remarkably in the past 15 or 20 years. So, and it's not that we, you know, need white people to support the reparations struggle. They're like icing on the cake. But it's interesting to see that there are people meeting now, organizing, who are white about the issue of reparations.
Yeah, it is interesting. Let's get one more caller before we got to go, and I know you got to make your appointment. Caller, you're on the air with Dr. Ray Winbush. What's your name, caller?
Hello, my name is Jerry Stevens, and I have been listening to the whole conversation, and I think reparations are a pipe dream, and the reason why I say that is because to initiate reparations, they would have to go all the way back in their history. And the documents that they depend on to establish this particular government and thing, they would have to remove that 3/5 of a person statement and consider all human beings as equal. And they are not willing to do that. And that's what lets you know that, you know, kind of like the racism is here to stay. Because until you do that, once you declare someone as 3/5 of a human being, what is that?
I don't know. I don't think they'd have to do that. What do you think, Ray? Hold on, caller.
They wouldn't have to. Yeah, I mean, you know, John Hope Franklin, who was my teacher in Chicago, used to say that the Constitution was a flawed document. We see that now.
Yeah. Turn your radio down, caller, Jesse.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
Okay, go ahead, Ray.
Yeah, I mean, the Constitution of the United States was a flawed document from the very beginning, which you just quoted about the 3/5 Amendment, not including the only people that could vote were white men who owned land. So it was a flawed document, but it's not that connected to the reparations struggle. We will always have racism. Derrick Bell, the great legal scholar, said that. And it will not go away. We're not going to have a day in, I don't know, 2088, said we remember when we had racism. It's going to be here. And I think what we've got to do is say, within that system of racism, like Neely Fuller and Francis Cress-Welsing said, how do you move, operate, organize, and work in the system of racism? And one of the ways you work is to advocate for reparations. I don't think those are connected. It would be nice, but I don't think they're going to be changing the Constitution anytime soon unless this idiot in the White House tries to do that.
Well, you know, he's doing a lot of crazy stuff. But Jesse, also know this. Carla, you still there? Also know this.
Yes, I'm here.
The 14th Amendment actually already reversed the 3/5 clause. It was already reversed.
I think it just, excuse me. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
No,
go ahead.
Let me just say this real quick. By the way, today is the anniversary of the 14th Amendment. Go
wow,
ahead.
Wow, isn't that something? Jesse, you were trying to say something too, real quick?
Oh, no, I was really just listening to what, you know, your response to it. But again, the reason why I just have these feelings about reparations and even after Obama became president, you know, because my whole comment, even though, you know, I was hopeful and I voted for him and was glad that he got through his administration without the taint.
Right,
we have going on now. It just seems to be a basic premise that if people don't consider you a human being, then what do they consider you, and why would they do anything for you?
But if we can't be paralyzed by that, it's the enslaved have to change the enslavers. That's how we got out of slavery. Jesse, thank you for your call. Dr. Ray Winbush, folks, check out his books, Should America Pay, Belinda's Petition, The Warrior Method. Ray, thank you, man. Appreciate you, Ray. Thank you so much. Bye-bye. All right, folks, this has been What's at Stake.
WPFW listeners, summertime is here. Words, Beats, and Life has the event for your family and friends this season. The second annual DMV Made Festival is happening Saturday, July 26th on the National Mall, a one-day celebration of the D.C., Maryland, Virginia region, promoting the intersections of arts and culture, plus health and wellness. With live music by Go-Go Legends, EU, featuring Sugar Bear, vocalist Navasha Deya, jazz fusion trio The Mesthetics, Black Folks Don't Swim, Kamau, and much more. Plus Family Fun Zone, Poetry and Storytelling Pavilion, Interactive Dance Stage, Live Art Installations, Hands-On Workshops, and Health and Wellness Pavilion. July 26th on the National Mall. Full details at wblinc.org/DMVMade. See you there. Brought to you by Words, Beats, and Life with support from WPFW.
Code Pink Women for Peace is coming to you live from Washington, D.C. and New York City, Thursday at 11 a.m. Code Pink Radio is an energizing new program focused on ending wars and militarism and building a peace economy. Listen weekly to robust conversation and inspiration from grassroots peacemakers from places like Korea, Yemen, Venezuela, Palestine, and Iran, as well as peacemakers in our nation's capital who are confronting war hawks in the White House and in Congress and modeling the actions we want our government to take. Again, that's Code Pink Radio, Thursdays at 11 a.m. on Washington, D.C.'s WPFW and New York City's WBAI, an engaging hour of cutting-edge conversation not to be missed.
We are women of the world. We're from the east, south, north, and west.
Wondering how to get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support jazz and justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at wpfwfm.org. Again, that's wpfwfm.org.
The talk show Africa Now airs Wednesdays at 1 p.m. It's a modern view on historical issues concerning the entire African world, addressing how African people are participating in globalization, ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
This is Rev Yearwood, and I am so excited to announce our new climate show, Think 100% Climate Friday. This show will keep you up to date on everything climate justice related in a rapidly changing world. We will discuss breaking news and updates on environmental issues, the climate crisis, COVID-19, and politics. This show will make tangible how the climate crisis is already impacting our lives and what you can do about it. So tune in every Friday at 9 o'clock a.m. right here on WPFW 89.3, your jazz and justice station.
Are you ready? The Birchmere presents Omar, July 17th. Hubert Laws, July 20th. Hiroshima, July 24th. And Sheila E., July 30th. Details at thebirchmere.com.
Thank you. Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this